From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
At the Vatican, in his own Easter message, Pope Benedict also did not discuss the sex abuse cover-up controversy swirling around the Catholic Church. But this holiday comes 3 days after a Vatican preacher likened criticism of the Pope's leadership to attacks on Jews before the Holocaust.
Good Friday kicked off yet another decidedly bad week for the Catholic Church this year. A hebdomus horribilis, if you will. During Mass at St. Peter's Basilica, the preacher to the papal household compared criticism of the church over its handling of abuse allegations to the historical persecution of Jews. He later apologized, but that didn't stop a senior cardinal at the Vatican from referring on Easter Sunday to media coverage of the scandals as, quote, petty gossip. John Allen Jr. is a senior correspondent with the National Catholic Reporter. He reminds us that's not all that went wrong for the church last week.
Well, you know, in the news business, we say that a story has legs if fresh developments keep it alive. And the truth is, this story has more legs than a centipede. In just the last week, I mean, what we've seen is, first of all, a rash of senior church officials, including Vatican cardinals, who have in one way or another gone on record suggesting that there is a media campaign against the Pope. We have seen a Catholic bishop in Norway who has been forced to resign after admitting that he sexually abused an altar boy 20 years ago. We have seen two cases of priests from the United States who were credibly accused of sexual abuse. Their cases ended up in the Vatican, and either nothing happened or it took so long for something to happen that critics are suggesting that it's effectively meaningless. We have a growing conversation in England among certain human rights groups who are actually proposing that when Benedict arrives in the UK in September, that he ought to be served with an arrest warrant under the principle of universal jurisdiction for his alleged role in a global conspiracy to protect pedophile priests. We have also seen an announcement from a group of sexual abuse victims, including two of the victims who met with Benedict when he was in the United States in 2008, announcing plans effectively to lead a march on Rome in October. Their idea is to bring some 50,000 victims of sexual abuse directly to St. Peter's Square in order to, more or less, drop this problem on the Pope's doorstep.
And the Pope is right at the center of a lot of the controversy, as he has been for a good part of his papacy. Take me a trip down that bad memory lane.
It's been a rocky road, Bob, for sure. I mean, we can wind the clock back to 2006, when the Pope gave a speech at Regensburg in Germany, which infuriated Muslim opinion around the world when he appeared to link the Prophet Muhammad with violence. A couple of years ago, there was a case in which he lifted the excommunications of four traditionalist Catholic bishops, including one who was a Holocaust denier. That, of course, caused an explosion in Catholic-Jewish relations. Last March, while the Pope was on the way to Africa on the papal plane, he made a comment to the effect that condoms actually make the problem of AIDS worse. That, too, triggered a cause celeb. In fact, among other things, the Spanish government shipped off 1 million condoms to Africa in protest.
Now, strictly speaking, the Pope is not supposed to be a politician measuring his every word, but as a practical matter, he is a political figure on the world stage. And I guess, looking at it, you know, as cold-bloodedly as I can, he's kind of for a politician, a PR disaster.
I think you could probably take kind of out of that sentence and be a little closer to the truth. I mean, look, the practical reality is, first of all, culturally speaking, the Vatican thinks in centuries, which means it is not crafting its decisions on the basis of today's headlines, and it doesn't think about communication strategy the way that other institutions do. Add to that the fact that the present Pope, Benedict XVI, is an academic. I mean, he is much more given to the life of the mind than he is to playing on the world stage. And then I think third, whenever there is a perception that the Pope is under attack, there is a kind of genetic instinct in the Catholic world to sort of circle the wagons and protect the boss. You know, you wrap those three things up together, and they are quite often a prescription for seeming terribly tone-deaf about how to project a positive message for the church.
All right. Now, I also don't want to trivialize the horror of child abuse by suggesting that it's somehow just a PR matter for the church. But what strikes me about this latest outburst of scandal is that Pope Benedict has really been at the forefront of the reform in the church's behavior with respect to child abuse allegations. To say the least, the church has squandered whatever political capital it has gained by him, you know, at long last, after centuries, dealing with this problem forthrightly.
You've put your finger on what is, for me, the central irony of this storyline, which is that really from 2001 forward, there is no figure at the senior level of the Catholic Church who has done more to promote an aggressive response to the problem of sexual abuse by clergy than the present pope. I mean, when he was still Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger in charge of the Vatican's response to this crisis, he is the guy who kick-started the wheels of justice into motion to remove predator priests from the priesthood. As pope, he is the first pope ever to meet with victims. He is the first pope ever to apologize in his own name for the crisis. He is the first pope who sort of broke the Vatican's wall of silence. And in effect, he has embraced a zero tolerance policy. And yet you're quite right that that story has really dropped out of sight amid coverage of the cases that have recently come to light, because the response from church officials, not just the Vatican, but certainly including the Vatican, has created a public impression of kind of denial and finger-pointing at the media, which makes it really impossible for them to successfully mount any kind of defense of the way that the Pope has responded to this.
You know, I have to ask you, if it is indeed obvious that for truth and reconciliation to take place, first you have to have truth, because in the eyes of the Church, the Pope is infallible, it somehow becomes ecclesiastically impossible to acknowledge that he may have in his record some degree of culpability?
Well, here, Bob, I think you have to distinguish between official Catholic theology and popular Catholic psychology. In terms of the official theology, a pope is infallible only when he teaches definitively in union with all the bishops of the world on matters of faith or morals. So, you know, when a pope says there are three persons in the Trinity, that is presumed to be infallible. But that writ of infallibility doesn't mean that every judgment call he makes is somehow protected from error. And in fact, you know, when popes come up for sainthood, the Vatican will routinely say that declaring a pope a saint is not the same thing as ratifying every policy choice during his pontificate. So in principle, there would be no impediment to acknowledging managerial or administrative mistakes. But in terms of popular Catholic psychology, I think that's the bridge that is yet to be crossed. I think what happened 8 years ago when this crisis erupted in the United States, and you may remember that in the first wave of commentary from bishops here in the States, there was a tendency to deny that anything had gone wrong, to minimize the crisis, and to blame the media for bringing it up in the first place. And on the back of hard experience, bishops and other church officials had to learn a new vocabulary for talking about how the church corporately had failed and was in need of reform. Well, that bridge has been crossed. What they don't yet have is a similar vocabulary for talking about the mistakes of a pope. That, I think, is precisely the learning curve that the Catholic Church is on at the moment. The real question, the drama of all this is, are they going to complete that learning curve in time to dig themselves out from this mess, or at the end, is it going to be too little too late?
Thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Bob.
John Allen is a senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter.
On Monday, WikiLeaks posted a leaked video from a 2007 American military operation that killed 12, including two Reuters journalists. The aerial footage was from an American helicopter gun camera as soldiers mistook journalists' camera equipment for weapons. We see the targets marked by crosshairs. We see the bodies fall.
Roger, engage. 1-8, engage. Clear. Come on.
Many argued whether the gun camera video captured a too casual attitude toward killing or a tragic mistake by soldiers hovering over a war zone. Here's WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange on why he released the video.
We really have unique material that shows how modern aerial warfare is done. Hasn't been revealed before. It seems like they are playing video games with people's lives.
Journalist Clive Thompson, a columnist for Wired magazine and a contributor to the New York Times magazine, says the footage does remind him of the video game Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, specifically the level called Death from Above.
It's pretty similar. In fact, I've talked to soldiers that have been playing war video games for years, and they have frequently said how startlingly similar a lot of the visualization on some of the weapon systems are. You know, when you look into, you know, a rocket launcher in a game, it can look quite similar to when you're looking into a rocket launcher in reality.
And video games are used to train soldiers. Part of the training is to sharpen skills, but people who train soldiers also say that part of it is to depersonalize the enemy.
Yeah. The military has actually spent like 100 to 200 years trying to get soldiers to kill people. One of the things they found coming out of the First World War was that a lot of soldiers, even faced with gunfire right in their face by the enemy, would not return fire. So the military worked for years on operant conditioning, when something pops up, just sort of shoot at it, to get past this innate resistance to taking human life. And I think one of the reactions people are having to that video is that the behavior, judging by the audio, seemed kind of callous. And it seemed that there was this deep remove and lack of sense that there are actually people there. This gets into very complex terrain because, you know, to some extent, this is exactly what we as a society require the military to do. We require them to basically put people in situations where they are able to kill people without being tormented by it for the rest of their lives. And that's why I'm sort of a little uncomfortable judging what's going on in that video. Apart from, I think, the perfectly legitimate question of, there is a moral and ethical aspect to the way you design weapon systems. It's been generally acknowledged that the further away the person is, the less you can see them, the more they're just a blip on the screen, the easier it is to pull the trigger.
And a lot of people say that the problem is that killing in real life is feeling more and more like a video game. But the fact is, killing in war is more like a video game.
Sure. Predator drone strikes, they're highly virtualized situations, right? I mean, you have someone sitting on American soil or in a nearby country, you know, piloting a drone able to shoot and kill. And so everything is done through an interface in the same way that everything on a video game is done through an interface. It's going to be a constant question for us as a society and for the military whether or not, as they become more game-like, that creates an effect that makes it easier to kill people in a way that you might not want to make it easier to kill people.
So, Clive, a moment ago you were talking about the moral implications of building weapon systems that feel like video games and that they put more distance between a soldier and his or her target. Are there any war games that shrink that distance?
Yeah. Video games have actually gotten more morally complex as time goes on. There's a game called God of War, its third sequel in the series, and you're this very violent creature going around just like slaughtering stuff in your path. And there's a striking moment in this third game where you are suddenly teleported into the eyes of someone that you're attacking while you're attacking them. So even as you're controlling your protagonist and trying to kill this other creature, you are in that creature's eyes looking at yourself.
Wow.
Killing yourself. And you realize that you look incredibly terrifying and that everyone you've killed has seen you coming at them like this absolutely nightmarish spectacle. And it's a very, very interesting moment. And there's been more moments like these inside games. I mean, war games in particular, what they've done, they've put a lot of situations in which there are innocent bystanders, there are civilians, there are people you're not supposed to kill, and if you make the wrong decision, you can have a very detrimental impact on the way the game's played.
What's the detrimental impact on the game?
Well, your mission might end. You might flub the mission.
Video games used in military training may desensitize you. Can we foresee games that would sensitize you?
Sure, sure. In fact, you've already seen them. If you look away from the big budget war games, there's been a real ferment amongst these smaller, independent, almost art games, really, that have tried to basically use games as a mechanism to think about moral decisions, ethical decisions, emotional decisions in everyday life and how they affect you. And there was this very famous game that came out about a year and a half ago called Passage. It literally looks like you're playing some crazy game from like 15 years ago, tiny little blocky characters, and you have just this tiny little strip, and you walk around. It's only 3 minutes long. you die, always in 3 minutes. And you notice that your character is sort of getting older as you walk, and it becomes a sort of memento mori game where, like, you only have a limited time. How much can you explore? Why would you want to explore? And you can also pair up with a woman, but the two of you age together and she dies before you. And when you're paired up, there's some places you can't go inside the little maze. It was a very simple game, but metaphorically, it mimicked and made you think in the way that a good poem does about aspects of life and death and how the choices you make affect what happens to you.
So it's possible, certainly, you're saying, within this medium to create opportunities to consider one's place in the world, to look at complex moral issues, but like a good poem, it won't sell.
Yeah, well, big budget games these days, they cost like $10 million to make. And so if they're going to make money back, they have to stick to these very tried and true genres. It doesn't mean that the big games won't chip away at these questions of morality that are very interesting, but it can never really be their primary directive because they're trying to make back $10, $20, $30, $100 million.
So is there any proof that playing violent video games makes us more violent?
No. No generally agreed upon studies have found that. They've found temporary aggressiveness, like you know, for the next 5 minutes, you might be kind of jittery and whatnot, but they haven't really been able to demonstrate that people that play a lot of violent video games are not already violent, are going to go out and be more violent or desensitized. You know, we've been playing really violent games for 20 years now, and rates of violence amongst the people who play them the most, young people, have just sort of steadily gone downwards. So we're running the experiment, and it seems to be coming up zero in that regard. I think some of this has to do with the fact that games fundamentally are about playing, which means you're trying to accomplish these missions. And sometimes when you're playing a shooting game, it's really just like hitting a target over and over again. You might as well be throwing a ball at a can on a fence. And after a while, you sort of stop even noticing the cultural totems on the screen. Here's a really good example. The Medal of Honor series is, you know, a violent video game set in World War II. There was a version of it called Rising Sun, where you went to Japan and you killed a lot of Japanese soldiers as an American. This game was released in Japan, and a lot of commentators, myself included, said, is that a good idea? Are young Japanese men going to want to sit around for hours upon hours slaughtering virtual representations of their fathers and grandfathers? But the game did quite well. And when I talked to some players of the game, they said, after a while, I don't even notice who I'm killing because it's just a really good game.
But a game is a game is a game. They aren't really killing their fathers and grandfathers. They're just firing colored lights at colored lights.
Yeah, and as I've always said, and I still firmly believe, you have to be pretty unglued to seriously mix up reality and fantasy in a game world. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about a lot of ultra-violent video games is that, you know, if you stand back and look at it from 10 feet away, you often go, wow, that's just sick. And if you're playing it, it's often sometimes weirdly funny because it's so over the top. It's more like Quentin Tarantino than Saving Private Ryan.
Or maybe Monty Python.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, it's just a nick. Sometimes I think games that actually have a kind of a moral commentary on violence are the ones that push it to an absolutely ludicrous extreme, in the same way that in Ovid's Metamorphoses, when he describes battle scenes, it's not just cutting off someone's head. He, like, goes on for stanzas about how the blood, you know, shot to the ceiling and knocked over lamps and stuff like that. And he was intentionally mocking the conventions. He was sort of, like, laughing at a lot of heroic war poetry at the same time as he was using that stuff.
And so, to sum up your position on the incident that prompted this discussion, the helicopter in Iraq, the panic over the fact that video games are so much like war is really a panic over the fact that war is fought so much more like a video game.
I think that they worry that soldiers put in these situations might treat reality without the gravity and purchase that it demands. But there is a famous example where someone was piloting a drone, they lost power on the drone. They were trying to land the drone safely, and just before the drone hit the ground, they reached below their seat for the ejection button because it just felt like they were there. And there's a lot of people who do work in cyborg psychology, what it feels like to be sort of working inside a machine, that would argue persuasively that, no, these systems don't desensitize you to the violence. You feel like you're there. The soldiers are trained to understand this stuff, and this isn't really a problem. are weapon systems designed in a way that they become game-like? Does that change the ethical dimensions of warfare? I think it's an incredibly interesting question that we are going to run into more and more because a lot of war is being fought virtually.
Clive, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson is a columnist for Wired and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine.
Who controls the internet is a complicated question, but as a practical matter, who controls the internet is whoever gets it to you. For most Americans, access is controlled by their internet service providers, or ISPs, Verizon, Time Warner, Comcast, and so on. And until this week, the only real check on ISPs' power was the Federal Communications Commission. It was in that capacity that the FCC sanctioned Comcast in 2008 for slowing internet speeds or for interrupting the service of customers who were uploading huge files on BitTorrent, essentially penalizing those customers for using too much bandwidth. But on Tuesday, an appeals court told the FCC that its censure of Comcast would not stand, that the FCC has no jurisdiction over internet regulation. That decision has freed up the ISPs to deliver the internet to their customers however they wish. What's more, it has jeopardized the FCC's most ambitious foray into internet regulation yet, its new national broadband stimulus plan. Gigi Sohn is the president of Public Knowledge, a group that advocates equal treatment for all internet users, what's known as net neutrality. Scott Cleland is president of Precursor LLC, an advocacy group funded by ISPs. Gigi and Scott, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Bob.
Yes, great to be here.
So let's start with something you can probably agree on, I hope. What is net neutrality? What does that mean? Gigi?
The internet is the most democratic medium the world's ever known. It was built to put control in the hands of the users, not control in the hands of the telephone companies and cable companies that provide the on-ramps to the internet. Net neutrality preserves that openness.
And Scott, tell me why that definition isn't exactly right. Or is it?
Companies are in the business of letting consumers get to the websites and the applications of their choice. That's their business. So they are interested in having an open and neutral internet. The difference is that it's being done that way and has been done and been done successfully in a voluntary way for the last 6 years. Literally in the quadrillions of communications that happen each year, there have been two incidents in 6 years that they've said were a problem. It's like saying, because there's two grains of sand that are a problem on the beach, let's shut down the beach. There's no need to regulate it because of all the unintended consequences that come along.
What is the fear of net neutrality advocates that ISPs will do if, in fact, there is no one to intervene?
Well, first of all, Comcast and the other incident that Scott refers to, they're not the only two incidents of blocking or throttling. So AT&T has already been known in its wireless service to block the Slingbox application, to block a Skype application. It censored a Pearl Jam concert because the band sang something that was negative about Bush. If you look at the terms of service of every single wireless company, they block certain applications. So there have been more than two grains of sand, but it's more than that. There are many, many other instances we may not even know about. Here's another important point. Pretty much every single company in this space has said that they want to charge Google, eBay, Amazon for quality of service, which means faster speed, less jitter. They've already said that. So the notion that they don't want to engage in anything but neutral behavior is just wrong. It's part of their business plan. They see the kind of money Google is making, and they say, I want to get me some.
Someone has to be paying attention to the business of the internet, to the openness of the internet, to the communications aspect of it. The government will have a role in this. The FCC planted its flag in the soil only to be turned back by the courts. If not them, who?
So Congress could pass a law giving the FCC the legal authority to protect consumers, but that would probably take years, if at all. and you have a highly partisan Congress, you already have the Republicans coming out and saying, we don't want the FCC to regulate this at all. So what happens to consumers in the meantime? I don't think the FCC has a prayer if it asks the D.C. Circuit, which is the court it lost in, to rehear the case. And they could even get a worse decision. So that's not an option. The FCC does have an option, though, that I and many others believe makes sense. It could reverse its 2002 decision that deregulated internet access in the first place. Okay, that's what got us into this mess.
Well, let's remember that Congress deregulated on an overwhelming bipartisan basis in 1996, and it has worked, and it has produced an internet what everybody thinks is a phenomenon that is extremely useful. So I kind of reject the notion that jurisdiction here is really important because consumers are getting the applications and the content of their choice. Why are we going through all of this enormously intrusive regulatory discussion that can essentially kill the goose that laid the golden egg?
But as the FCC itself said in introducing its 10-year broadband plan, we do have a problem. The costs are very high relative to the rest of the world. The download speeds and upload are very slow compared to the rest of the world, and no relief in sight. At a minimum, if the FCC loses jurisdiction here, what about its 10-year plan to bring the United States kicking and screaming into the 21st century?
I just have to completely reject that notion in the sense that the United States leads the world in broadband competition and in broadband, and the United Nations numbers say that the U.S. has the least expensive broadband out there. That's the fact. We have the highest utilization and the most use of any nation in the world. We also have more fiber deployment to the home than any nation in the world and more than Europe in entirety. So this notion that the United States behind is basically a ruse to regulate when it simply doesn't fit the facts.
I mean, of course we have the highest use because we have one of the biggest countries in the world, okay, other than China, which isn't very advanced in its technology. So that's ridiculous. Every single international study has shown that we're like 15th, 20th in the world in speed and value. But I want to get back to your core point, Bob. The FCC's general counsel, Austin Schlicht, says that essentially half of the national broadband plan is jeopardized by the Comcast decision. The FCC wanted to increase funds for universal access to broadband. That's a jeopardy. Any subsidies for the poor to get broadband, to adopt broadband, consumer privacy protections, emergency communications for first responders, disability access, transparency rules that would allow consumers to know what kind of speed they're getting and what kind of network management their internet service providers are engaging in. That's all in jeopardy. Look, Congress told the FCC to do this national broadband plan. They weren't planning on it. They've been working night and day for the last 6 months, and last month they introduced an over 360-page plan. Without legal authority, they cannot implement half of that plan.
Look, the United States already has broadband available to like 95% of the country. Do they have competition in every place? Not yet, but competition is there in most places and it is available. It needs greater adoption, and that's where the focus should be.
How can we trust the ISPs, who seem to have structural conflicts of interest, to make the right decision for the society?
The reason you can trust the ISPs is they have done it and done it well for decades and certainly for the last 6 years where there haven't been these rules. And they have no interest in denying their consumers what they want. So the whole net neutrality debate is really a slogan in search of a problem.
Thank you both very, very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
G.G. Sohn is the founder and president of Public Knowledge. Scott Cleland is the founder and president of Precursor LLC. And now, an update. Last week, we reported on an ethical controversy brewing at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The dust-up began when an anonymous online commenter posted on the paper's website about the mental state of a reporter's relative. An editor investigated who was behind the comment and learned that the username was registered to an email address belonging to a local judge. That judge had also posted many strongly worded comments on cases she had presided over, as well as cases she's currently overseeing, including a high-profile murder prosecution. The Plain Dealer printed that judge's identity. We spoke to the editor, Susan Goldberg, about the incident and asked her whether the paper had committed an ethical lapse by stripping a specific commenter of her anonymity. Well, the judge in question, Shirley Strickland Saffold, seems to think so. This week, she sued the Plain Dealer for $50 million, alleging that the paper engaged in a conspiracy to publish her confidential information.
Coming up, the day authors first got rights to their own work. Meanwhile, jokes can't be copyrighted, so comics patent them with personality.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
What's the music that gets you through your commute? AM Jams is WNYC's new crowdsourcing project. Send in your song suggestions and help create the ultimate morning playlist. Or check out playlists of New York musicians and music critics, like this song, All Fires by Swan Lake, which trumpet player Christian Scott takes on his commute from Harlem to Union Square. Catch this song and share your morning songs. The Culture site wants you to have tunes you can use at culture.wnyc.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Call it the Magna Carta of copyright. England's Statute of Anne was born 300 years ago this weekend, and for the first time in history, it conferred upon authors certain rights for their work. Prior to the Statute of Anne, only favored guilds licensed by the crown had the legal right to publish and own work. Duke law professor James Boyle says the guilds, in effect, colluded with the crown to control the printed word.
Their claim was, we need effectively limited monopolies, we need these guild controls, because only with us, your reliable publishers working under these agreements, are you going to get the kind of responsible, non-heretical, non-insurrectionary press that you need. And as a result, they were able to wring what was effectively economic benefit out of playing their part in what was really a censorship regime.
But there were some strong objections to these licensing agreements. The poet John Milton wrote a famous speech, the Areopagitica, against licensing. He condemned it as censorship that killed reason itself.
Yes, absolutely. And Milton, one of the first and most eloquent defenders of freedom of expression. There was really this concern that this kind of prior restraint, as we call it today, was not needed, that instead you should just allow people to speak, to publish, and then if they've been heretical, why, you could burn them later. John Locke's concern was not just over the ability to speak in daring new ways. Locke's concern was also that we're not just transmitting knowledge reliably, that effectively by giving control of publication of the Greek and Roman classics to these publishers, that we didn't have access to good, low-cost editions.
These licensing rules expired in the 1690s, and newspapers grew in number and in influence, and this marks what many see as the birth of free speech in England.
the beginnings of what we would see as a kind of press that was actually bringing different perspectives on the news, the growth of the coffee houses where people were discussing ideas without regard to social class, the formation of this idea of an educated public that received different sources of news with different slants. All of these we take for granted today, but in many ways, the sources of them are in this period of growth in the 18th century, both before and after the Statute of Anne, I should say.
So in 1710 came the statute named after the Queen of England. What was it intended to do?
Up to this point, what we would call the copyright, which in those days was actually two separate words, had been held by the publishers, the people in the guild who basically had the right to print a particular book. Like in the old days before airline deregulation, someone had the right to fly from LaGuardia to Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
You had a right over a particular book, and that was the publisher's copyright, and it was enforced by guild rules. The guild said, nobody else gets to print this. The Statute of Anne conjures in what we would think of as a much more modern market. Now the right is named as the author's right. The author can choose who can copy it. And authors, we would look at it, will say, I'll go out and I'll find a publisher and I'll make my own deal and I'll decide how and whether this work is going to be published.
How did the publishers take this statute? Did they like it?
They did in part. They had been lobbying for it. They wanted a form of literary property. Publishers that were centered in London, who'd really controlled the business, almost monopolized it, wanted it because they wanted to deal with people they thought of as sort of pesky Scottish pirates who they thought were infringing on their business by printing books to which they had no right. The Scottish pirates, of course, said, you're printing absurdly high-cost, very bad quality editions, and we are serving the noble forces of spreading knowledge. It's almost like our wars in the digital domain today. To some of the publishers in London, the idea of getting this right, this statutory right for a limited time, might have seemed like a good idea because it said, hey, there is a right and it's a legal right and I can force it against you. To the publishers who were the insurgents, it might seem good because it said, now we're moving definitively away from this world of guilds where someone has a monopoly right over a particular type or form of publishing. So I think both of them saw pluses and minuses in the statute.
It seems like it probably was very good for authors too. I mean, you have Daniel Defoe, Alexander Pope, Jonathan Swift flourishing.
Something that is really sort of fascinating to me is the way that our modern conception of the author as this central figure, this original creator, really something that comes into sort of aesthetic prominence after the Statute of Anne. And it's almost like the right exists and then we sort of invent the aesthetics of originality and authorship. And the two sort of grow together throughout the 18th century.
So let's try to trace a path from the Statute of Anne to our modern day notion of copyright. When the United States was born, it wrote a copyright clause into its constitution, similar to the Anne Law, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writing and discoveries. So was this basically just a rewrite of the Statute of Anne?
It had a lot in common. The ideas of Milton and the Areopagitica and of Locke, those were incredibly important, particularly to Jefferson and to Madison. The second similarity is there was marked hostility in England towards the monopolies, and the original framers of the Constitution, particularly the framers of the Intellectual Property Clause, were really concerned about monopolies. They worried about the state being able to hand out these lengthy grants of monopoly power to private individuals who thereafter could basically hold society hostage. Sadly, the latter concern has kind of waned in recent years, but at the time when they wrote the Constitution, they appeared to care about it a great deal.
In the original 1790 Copyright Act, the author was given a term of 14 years in which no one else could encroach on their work. If they were still alive at the end of that period, they could renew it for an additional 14 years.
You give the limited right to the author to encourage production and distribution, and then you end the term and you have this world of free competition. Sadly, in the world of copyright at least, we've given up on that and we have continued to lengthen the term to a point which is now utterly ridiculous. Copyright today lasts for your life plus 70 years. It's very hard to incentivize dead people to produce new things, but Congress apparently believes that it can.
Well, what you're saying is that if the idea here is to promote our intellectual lives and educate people, extending the copyrights of dead people is not likely to lend itself to that effort.
The tragic thing is that the people who wrote the Statute of Anne and the people who wrote the U.S. Constitution really thought that copyright's goal was about promoting access to knowledge. The idea of a limited term, of holding copyright short, that was central to that notion. That's how we disseminated the ideas. And of course, since lots of works are commercially unavailable, and we don't know who the copyright holders are, we can't find them, they're so-called orphan works. In many cases, copyright acts as a fence, which means you can't distribute works. Even if you wanted to pay, you can't pay. There's no one you can pay to make a new edition, to make a movie out of it. In this case, it's a one-way valve. Copyright takes the stuff in, almost like a black hole, locks it up, and now you can't get it out. This is exactly the opposite of the idea behind the U.S. Constitution, and also, I think, behind one of the animating impulses of the Statute of Anne, which is, let's promote the flourishing of human creativity.
Jamie, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
James Boyle is a law professor at Duke University. 3 years ago, a comedian named Joe Rogan was on stage hosting a night of stand-up comedy when he spotted fellow comedian Carlos Mencia in the audience. Rogan started making fun of Mencia, referring to him as Carlos Menstelia, a reference to allegations that Mencia had cribbed liberally from the routines of fellow comedians Ari Shaffir, Bobby Lee, and George Lopez. Mencia jumped on stage to defend himself, and soon an impromptu comedy trial began with a boozy Saturday night comedy crowd adjudicating.
If someone steals a riff from a song, that's in the news constantly. Yeah. Motherfuckers steal shit and make it on HBO.
It
they steal and put it on television. What do you say?
No, let me tell you what I think. I think that every time you open your mouth and talk about me, I think that you're secretly in love with me. That's what I personally think.
The tape of the confrontation wound up online, where it was viewed more than 5 million times. That's how law professors Chris Sprigman and Dotan Aliar saw it, and it got them thinking about intellectual property law and comedy. Jokes are hard to copyright. You can patent the delivery, but not the idea. Given that confusing distinction and the high cost of lawyers, comedians ply their trade without the benefit of legal protection. So how do they protect their jokes? Sprigman and Oliar did a study. Chris, Dotan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Without formal copyright protection, Dotan, how do stand-ups stop people from stealing their bits?
They're using a system of social norms that help them protect their rights in jokes and bits.
What you're saying is comedians are using moral suasion to get each other not to steal from each other?
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. The major sanction is reputational. So in that business, reputation is everything. And if you have bad reputation, agents are not going to want to represent you. Club owners might not want to have you in their club. People are not going to be willing to work with you on a comedy bill, like 8 or 10 comedians would work every night. And if you can't find other people who are willing to share the stage with you, you're pretty much going to be out of work. And then the last enforcement mechanism is physical violence or threats of physical violence.
Can you give me an example where physical violence was used on a repeat offender?
George Lopez, who's a pretty famous comedian, bragged a bit about how he'd jacked Carlos Mencia up against a wall and roughed him up after Mencia, at least in Lopez's view, took a whole bunch of Lopez's material and used it in one of Mencia's specials, I think for HBO. Generally, these disputes are settled. They don't come to blows like this. But if joke stealing is persistent and the joke stealer is recalcitrant, then you might eventually see something like this happen.
So what's going to stop Carlos Mencia in the end?
Well, the norm system, I think, has a weakness, which is it's difficult to enforce against someone who's truly both successful and a bit of a sociopath, right? So I'm not saying that that's what Mencia is, but if he is, if he doesn't really care about what other people think of him, then he's hard to discipline. But of course, you know, the norm system has to be compared with the formal copyright law, which is difficult to enforce too, because it's so expensive to bring a lawsuit in federal court that often it's just not worth it, right? So both systems have their flaws. The norm system flaws are not, obviously, at least to us, worse than the legal system's flaws.
Well, let's talk about the legal system's flaws. One of the arguments people make for formal and thorough copyright protection is that it encourages people to innovate because they can own their intellectual work. So does the lack of formal copyright protection stop people from innovating?
The reason why we started this research is with that question. How come so many comedians are creating without any effective legal protection? The interesting thing we saw here that A, the norm system, substitutes and supplements the law and can act as an effective incentive mechanism. But also another interesting thing is that we noticed some connection between the form of protection and then the character of the creative art. Those social norms that we've just described to you, they did not always exist. The norm in the business was that you could steal. And before the emergence of norms, jokes were like text that anyone could read, right? When the norms emerged in the 50s and 60s with comedians like Lenny Bruce, you cannot just take a joke from another person and tell it as yours, right? Comedians have character, and some narratives are tailored to their persona.
For instance, Sarah Silverman has a certain kind of outrageous joke.
Right, so Sarah Silverman's a great example of what we're talking about.
Guess what, Martin Luther King? I had a dream too. I had a dream that I was in my living room, and I walked through to the backyard, and there's a pool, and as I'm diving in, there's a shark coming up from the water with braces. So maybe you're not so special. Martin Loser King. Yeah.
It makes sense only from within the persona that Sarah Silverman has constructed, this intelligent but completely obtuse monster, right, that she is on stage.
Mm-hmm.
For someone to take that joke and have it make sense, they have to, in a sense, do the work to reconstruct enough of her persona that it makes sense. And to boot, if somebody takes that joke, it's much more readily identifiable as Sarah Silverman's, right? It comes in essentially marked with her persona,
mm-hmm.
which helps the norm system enforce her property rights.
And if you contrast that with, say, a Henny Youngman joke, any number of Borscht Belt comedians could say it.
Yeah, exactly. So here's a Henny Youngman joke.
A lot of people say, how do you stay married for 41 years? Here's the secret. My wife and I go to a romantic restaurant twice a week. A little candlelight, a little wine. She goes Tuesdays, I go Fridays.
You could tell it no matter who you were. It doesn't have much to do with Henny Youngman's persona.
There are accounts of Milton Berle going uptown in Manhattan to comedy clubs, sitting in the front row with a pen and paper. He would also joke publicly about his practice. When his turn would come up in a comedy club, he would start his bit by saying, the last guy was so funny, I laughed so hard I almost dropped my pad and pencil.
In the post-vaudeville period, and there's nothing wrong with that. Those were the norms.
So what industries other than comedy managed to innovate and build on each other's art without formal copyright protection?
Well, a good example of this is the fashion industry. Fashion designs are essentially free to copy, and yet every season you get a huge outpouring of new designs from thousands and thousands of firms and designers competing in an industry that's probably worth about $200 billion a year just in the U.S.
Another area is cuisine. It seems to me that there isn't a structure of social norms working on the inventors of recipes. They just go ahead as comedians did in the vaudeville days.
Again, the leading norm is that it's not okay to exactly copy a fellow top French chef recipe and serve it in your restaurant. However, those who play by the rules get cooperation and sharing of ideas and cooking techniques, and those who do not play by the rules are being kept out of the inner circle.
So what lesson are we to draw from the evolution of social norms for stand-up comics in place of formal copyright protection? That it's always better not to have copyright protection?
We have charted three different possibilities, right? The old Borscht Belt model, where you have comedians telling kind of jokes on stage with a rim shot at the end, or we have the current stand-up world where you have people standing on stage with personal, point-of-view-driven narratives, or we can have a potential future where there's strong legal protections, corporations sweep in because of economies of scale in enforcement and clearing rights, and then humor is being cleansed, turning away from the cutting edge and becoming more family-friendly. And whether you want or you do not want legal protection depends on what world do you prefer to live in.
What world do you guys prefer to live in?
Well, it's a matter of taste, but the world that we live in now is pretty attractive to me. comedians have enough of an incentive to create that we get a really robust market. It's very free. It's very diverse. There are a lot of different voices, and it's funny.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Chris Sprigman and Dotan Aliar are intellectual property law professors at the University of Virginia Law School. We'll end with this unstealable Bill Cosby classic.
And because of my father, between the ages 7 through 15, I thought my name was Jesus Christ. The Jesus Christ! And my brother Russell thought his name was Dammit. Dammit, will you stop all that noise? Jesus Christ, sit down! So one day I'm out playing in the rain. My father said, Dammit, will you get in here? I said, Dad, I'm Jesus Christ.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. You can also visit our Facebook page or Twitter us. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.